Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today.
Hello and welcome to The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church, which is located in Orpington, Kent, a southeastern suburb of London. We meet each Sunday at 10:30 a.m. for divine service. I'd like to invite you along to that. Also, we meet at the Reina Mission, which meets the first Sunday of each month at 3 p.m. Or I also am vacancy pastor of St. Columba Lutheran Church in East Kilbride, Scotland. They meet each Sunday at 11 a.m. I'd like to invite you along to attend a service there. But if you don't live in any of these areas, why not go to our website, lutheran.co.uk, click on the directory button, find the congregation closest to you, go and pay them a visit. I know you'll receive a warm welcome. Thank you again for your prayers and for your financial support for Lutheran Radio. We deeply appreciate your continued support, for without your prayers, without your contributions, we wouldn't be able to carry on this ministry of bringing the gospel of Jesus to people around the world. And we are very, very deeply grateful to you. Today, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Joel Bierman. He's professor of systematic theology at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri. We're discussing a paper he recently gave to the International Lutheran Council's World Seminaries Conference. And welcome back, Dr. Bierman.
It's great to be back.
The name of your paper was No Longer Married, But Still Engaged. Can you give us a sort of a brief recap of why you called it that, and perhaps, again, a little bit about what we were talking about last week?
Yeah, my goal is simply to point out the situation of the church in the modern world in which we're living in the West, that the church is no longer enjoying a privileged position of being invited to the table and into the halls of power and into the halls of influence in the culture in which we live. And it's not just the government I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about entertainment and literature and all the arts and just all the kind of basic functioning aspects of society. Increasingly, those kinds of cultural things are content to kind of go their own way without the influence of the church or without a need to keep the church happy. And so what we see is the church increasingly feeling itself shunted off to the margins of society and to the culture, and no longer being a key integral part of things, but sort of being a ancillary thing as an option. And that's one of the key things we're talking about, the idea of nihilistic idea of a culture, the normal nihilism, where the church just becomes one more choice, one more option among many. And the question then becomes, what does the church do about that? How do we respond to that? How do we deal with that? And so my argument is that the church needs to stay engaged in the culture, not only the government, but also in just the wider culture, and continue to engage the world around and not to retreat into a sort of a monastic ideal or a compound mentality where we're going to build the walls and escape from the culture. No, we need to continue to engage the culture. So we might not enjoy the privilege of being married and being part of the power brokers of the world, but we are still absolutely called upon to be engaged in that world in which we live.
And it's interesting because you talked, first of all, about the Constantinian approach that tied the church and the state together. And while that is dying in Europe, it is still interesting that the church, if you ask people today, at least in the UK, the church is seen almost as the state's handmaiden. Whatever the state declares morally, culturally, the church is expected to fall in step with. Again, how is that in the States, and how do you view that as having an impact upon the church today and how people see it?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, because the situation in the U.S. not having a state-established church probably shifts that quite a bit, because we don't have an assumption that the church's job is simply there to uphold the state and uphold the wider cultural thing, because the church, and here I'm using it in the broadest possible sense of being faithful followers of Christ, exist in many different kind of manifestations in the U.S. You have vast number of denominations and even divisions within those denominations. And so we don't have one unified group that speaks as the church. The church has lots and lots of multifaceted manifestations. And so it's a little different. So you don't really, I don't think, have an expectation from anybody that the church should be falling in line with the government or supporting it. rather you have Christians kind of trying to figure out how to stay relevant, how to stay involved, how to stay influential, and maybe try to how to save the culture to bring it back and more in line with the Christian thinking. That tends to be more the situation here in the U.S.
You have a very similar situation in Britain where people want to go back to the good old days, the Victorian times where the church had great influence, and many even in the church long for that. But that's not really realistic, is it?
Not at all. And that's the point that I think we need to come to terms with. We have the situation here very strongly, especially in the more conservative churches and in my own Lutheran church, the Missouri Synod here. We have a strong tendency among people to try to go back to the, you know, recapture something, if not back from the 19th century, certainly, you know, at least the 1950s, you know, when people were good God-fearing people and the church mattered, and you have this yearning for this. I would argue that that's not something we should want to go back to anyway, because that becomes that Constantinianism. And you have to ask the question of what was the church like in that stage? How much did the church have to compromise itself to make itself acceptable to that culture? So I don't think that's a goal we should have anyway. And even if it was possible, if it's not possible for it to happen anyway, it's just not going to happen because the culture's push down this road of enlightenment, there's no going back. We can't recapture, and it's not going to matter who is in office or what kind of laws we pass. It's not going to change the fundamental way that people think, the way that they operate, the way that they see and encounter their world. Those things are what they are. And so my argument is the church needs to be investing its time not in lamenting the past or in trying to recapture the past or even trying to rebuild a more influential church. No, the church needs to simply focus on its task of being the church faithfully, being a community set apart from the world, a community that focuses on following Christ and then impacts the world by living that kind of life in the world all the time in our lives.
And as confessional Lutherans, is there anything in particular, anything special that perhaps we can offer the world or the society from an Orthodox Lutheran perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. Because what we understand very clearly is this marvelous thing called the gospel. Then this is where the church needs to have courage and really zeal, a great deal of zeal and owning its story and declaring it. Because what we have in the church, and I'm thinking about Lutheranism as being a very articulate, faithful spokesman of that truth for the whole church. So I don't operate with this idea that there's Lutheran doctrine and we got our own little kind of thing. I think Lutheranism speaks for Orthodox Christianity very faithfully. And what Orthodox Christianity has with our Lutheran voice is a clear understanding of the forgiveness of sins in Jesus Christ and the understanding of being God's creature, put here in the world for a purpose, loved by God, redeemed by Christ, with a promise for a future resurrection and restoration of the whole creation, that changes everything. It tells me who I am. It gives me meaning for my life. It gives me purpose. I realize it's not just a nihilistic crapshoot that I just kind of take my chances and pick and choose whatever I want. No, I'm God's creature. And people, frankly, are longing for this kind of certainty and this kind of conviction. And the church has this. The church needs to be courageous enough and certain enough of its own message to declare that to people and say, here's the thing you're lacking. It's the direction of for your life. It's the telling you who you are. It's giving you your identity and giving you joy in living those things out. We as Lutherans know this. This is core to our teaching. Augsburg Confession, Article 4. We maintain man is justified by grace through faith, apart from observing works of the law. This is what we know. And this is what no one else in the world is hearing. No one's telling the gospel. No one's talking about being yielding yourself to God's truth given to us in Christ. The church has this. We need to be teaching this with unbridled joy and enthusiasm because it's what people need to hear.
And it seems to me, as I talk to people, that's not what they want to hear. And probably never have. But what I'm hearing people say, we want justice. We want justice for the environment. We want justice for civil rights. We want justice for this and that. They're not really interested in mercy or forgiveness. How can we bridge that gap?
Well, I think that's useful point you're bringing up. The people having this desire for justice, the question you need to ask them is, who's justice? And this is one of McIntyre's articles. Who's justice? Which rationality? Who decides what's just? Who decides what's rational? Who's making those decisions? And if we're going to be honest, we have to admit, well, it's really just me, unless there's actually a God. Then you have the question, well, if there's a God and he has justice, what are his standards? And what has he actually made clear to us? And then you start going to things like the natural law and the universal ideas of what's right and wrong. And then you can start ratcheting up what the law actually demands. And we're making standard Lutheran moves here now, saying, wait a minute, if you really want justice, you have to realize you're going to be on the wrong side of that equation. And what you really need is forgiveness from your failure to uphold justice. What you really need is mercy for your inability to be the kind of just person God wants you to be. So we're all desperately need a mercy in our own lives. And then we need to see how that mercy extends also within into the lives we live and share with others.
As we deal with others, I particularly like how you bring in the idea of the two realms that Lutherans teach. Can you tell us a little bit about those two realms and how that might help us engage in the public square?
Yeah, I'm personally very interested in the two realms and have done a fair amount of thinking there and a little writing about that. And I think the two realms is a tremendous gift that Luther brought to the church and his clarity of thinking about this. It's a biblical teaching, I would argue. It's a teaching the church has always recognized, but Luther articulates it very well. And the idea is simply that God rules over his creation in two very distinct ways. Now, the reason that they are distinct is because of the fall and because of the presence of sin in the world. The world is broken by sin, infected and polluted by man's sin, so everything is suffering because of that, which necessitates God watching over the world in these two very distinct ways. So you have, on the one hand, God ruling the world with his left hand. We sometimes talk about the left realm or the temporal realm. Then you have God caring for the world through his right hand or through the spiritual realm. The spiritual realm is the realm of the gospel, the declaration of the forgiveness of sins, the work of the church, the place of the pastoral office. The temporal realm is the place of justice and the law and God's will, which is what the law is, nothing more than God's will for how creation should work, with that guiding and directing. There you have governments and you have government officials enforcing this, making sure that people are following what God has given that they should do as part of this creation. And so the church needs to keep kind of clear what our objectives are in either realm. If I'm in the temporal realm, the realm of this world, this temporal created realm that I'm living in now, the goal is upholding truth and justice and upholding God's law. If I'm thinking about God's relationship to the world through the gospel, then the goal is that the gospel be declared. Now, these are not mutually exclusive, obviously, but it helps to kind of keep our focus on what we're trying to get done in either realm in which we're functioning.
And within those realms, we can be very politically active, I'm assuming, as Christians, or should even be.
Quite right. You see, the beauty of Luther's true teaching is it does not lead to a bifurcation of the realms, which is often a misunderstanding of Luther, and it does not lead to a mere quiescent, oh, just go along with whatever the powers say, which leads to all kinds of horrors, including the horror of the Third Reich back in the 20th century. This is not what Luther taught. Do Lutherans get Luther wrong and do this kind of thing? Yes, that has happened, and there's blame aplenty to go around for that. But Luther's true teaching was to say, no, the job of the state is to uphold justice. The job of the church is to proclaim the gospel. Christians who live in both realities can come to the state and say, wait, you're not being just. Wait, you're not upholding God's reality. And we should be challenging the state, and we should be challenging our wider culture and saying, no, what you're doing is violating God's truth. What you're doing is leading people to meaningless, silly lives. What you're doing is violating God's gift of life. Stop that. Stop doing that activity. Let's not do this. The church can do this. And then the question starts to come, well, how is the church most effective at this? And probably the church is the most effective at doing that when it encourages its individual members to be active in their individual lives, with their neighbors, their friends, their family, teaching God's truth in those situations, and then picking it into their workplaces and bringing God's truth in those places, rather than, by contrast, the church making kind of, you know, synod-wide dictums or, you know, passing resolutions or protesting. Those things tend to have very little impact. What's much more impactful is the individual Christian actually living out his conviction of what God calls him to do. So, should Christians be running for political office? Yes. Should Christians be involved in trying to influence and shape legislation? Yes. Always with the understanding that we're doing what we can. We're not trying to make a Christian nation. We're not trying to make the world more godly. What we're trying to do is uphold God's justice for the sake of the world a little more clearly.
But you hear people say, you can't do that. Your beliefs are influencing your policies. It's okay for you to be a Christian and have faith, but keep it to yourself.
Yeah, you're going to hear that a lot, and that makes great sense in a kind of a diverse, you know, normal nihilistic culture in which everybody gets to pick and choose. And I think the response needs to be, well, okay, so I'm not going to be able to convince you that my particular ideas are the true ones or that you think are true for you, but let me tell you that what I'm advancing is really not a particularly Christian worldview, but it's simply the way things are built into the world. You know that killing is wrong. You know that this action is wrong. And so we need to make appeals, I think, more based on what traditionally we called a natural law sort of appeal. This is not in a natural law that's at odds with God's revealed truth or is a kind of simplifying of that, but it's really the natural law is the sense of the built-in realities of how the world works, which is why people have a sense for what's fair and that you shouldn't steal what's not yours and killing is wrong and there's something, adultery is not right. Now people are defining those things, of course, in very flexible ways, but there's still a base fundamental idea at work that says these things are simply not right. That's an appeal to natural law. To me, that's a more fruitful way to go forward rather than just quoting Bible verses that people are trying to insist that they need to adopt our worldview. Rather appeal to the things that are just true in the base of our reality. You mentioned, I think last week when we talked about how young people will say, you know, we just need to be good and we need to care for the environment. Well, you need to kind of push a little bit. Why do you think that's good? Why is that right? And if they make an appeal like, well, it just is, you say, well, where did you get that? You see, that's where we start pointing out what you're doing is you're making a natural law argument. You just don't want to own that. But the fact that you want to say that that's just right proves that there's something more than simply your opinion because you're bound to something. Well, where did that something come from? And that's where we start making our kind of argument.
Yeah, that's a discussion I was just having the other day. Somebody was telling me, oh, I can say whatever I want. I can do whatever I want. And I said, yeah. That's fine until somebody badmouths you on social media or somebody sleeps with your boyfriend. Then it's not right. So it's interesting to sort of turn the argument back on itself.
That's right. And see, this is where I think what's going on in our culture today in this kind of nihilistic culture in which we're living, the moralistic therapeutic deism as a faith, is it's not consistent with itself. And people even know that, but they don't care. They don't care if they're being logically inconsistent. And they give themselves freedom to make all kinds of really boneheaded, illogical moves. And on things fundamental, like their basic morality, things that just don't add up at all, but they do it anyway. And I think maybe sometimes it's our job to challenge that a little bit and point out the inconsistency or the irrationality of the way they're functioning.
Now, I was also interested in the way you kind of brought your paper to a close. You talked about how we're finding ourselves in a society that is very much or very similar to that of the first century church, the society it found itself in. And again, I think in the UK, we're probably a little further down the line from you because nobody knows what the Bible is here anymore. You stop people on the street and ask them who Jesus is. They don't have a clue. So is this a bad thing or is this a good thing? How can we work in this sort of society, in this sort of new realm, as it were?
It's fascinating, but the shift of the culture that just has lost its moorings entirely, what do we do with that? And I think the answer again is that we do speak with confidence into that world. And the parallel with the first century, I think, is fascinating to me, or that maybe not first, second century, the early church. The Christians in the early Roman Empire, or the period of the birth of the church, were not influential. People did not care about Christians. And even the people who were of influence who became Christian, they were seen as kind of social outcast, kind of an oddity. And yet, in that culture, the church did very well simply by declaring God's truth, making the gospel known, and by living it out. One of the hallmarks, you'll see this from the early Roman period, the apologists and the other writers in that time period, were that the Christians were known by their love, not only for each other, but for non-Christians, for the marginalized, for the outcast, and for their commitment to actually following God's will. They didn't go to the Colosseum. They didn't participate in the things that their neighbors were doing. So the Christians were seen as different. And yet that very differentness is what was the attractive thing. And what I find really encouraging is that that early church seemed to do just fine in that culture. In fact, the church mushroomed and grew in spite of the pressure against it, in spite of the persecution, in spite of the indifference. So what the church, I think, needs to learn today in the 21st century is a confidence in the actual proclamation of God's word and doing the sacrament and practicing faithfully what it means to be church, and not expecting miraculous conversions of whole cultures all at once, and not looking for the big splash, you know, well, let's make a big impact, but just grinding it out in our faithful living, in our homes, in our marriages, in our congregations, in our neighborhoods, doing what God calls us to do, faithfully following Christ, serving our neighbors selflessly, speaking of the gospel of Christ whenever we have opportunity. Just do that, do that, do that. It makes an impact. Neighbors come to know Christ. Co-workers are influenced to become more just. It makes an impact. And over time, an authentic Christian proclamation can actually make an impact. And that's where maybe it's actually to our advantage to become marginalized, because now maybe we become this really strange voice, this strange word that sounds new. And maybe people will actually hear it for the first time because they've never really encountered it before. We have a great opportunity, I think, in the West, in spite of the godlessness of our culture. That's to our advantage, because now we can speak God's truth into that culture and do it with joy.
We've been talking a lot about the rampant individualism of our culture, but you bring your paper to a close, or at least part of your summary is how we need to really focus on the nurture of one another in community. What role does community play? Because I think there seems to be a real loss of community in our world. And how does that nurturing take place? How can the church really be a place of nurturing community?
Yeah, this is one of the really great things about the Christian faith, is that it's always been a communal thing. The disciples lived in community. The church has always functioned in community. There's an aspect that we are doing this together. There's no such thing as a lone ranger individualistic Christian, to make an American sort of reference to the lone ranger. But we don't do this on our own. We're not off being the rugged individualist, but we're doing this together. And the church needs to attend to that a lot more deliberately, I think. We need to be very intentional about cultivating our responsibility to each other, the bonds we have to each other. When you read the New Testament, it's crystal clear. Nobody goes this alone. We have responsibilities for each other. You know, the classic question Cain asked, am I my brother's keeper? The answer is a resounding yes, absolutely you are. You have a responsibility for each other. And so I think the church would be wise to be cultivating more community events together, having meals together, having evenings of fellowship, just enjoying each other's company, being really deliberate about working as maybe a social work, maybe helping a neighborhood kind of need and doing something for a concrete situation in a urban situation or in a rural situation and helping people and working together and doing the bonds of life together. And Bonhoeffer talked a lot about this. It's a consistent theme all through Christian history. And so the goal of the church then, I think, needs to zero more on how we help each other grow strong and taking care of each other as fellow Christians, and not worrying so much about maintaining buildings or maintaining our privileges or fighting for our civil rights. Those aren't the things we should be focused on. We shouldn't be focused on trying to restore Christianity's influence in the world by, you know, getting positions of power again. We should be focused more on how do we care for each other, look out for each other, and then cultivate the faith in our children, especially helping families to be strong families and nurturing families so that children grow up knowing Christ and walking with Christ.
Yeah, the God who sent his son to seek and save the lost, to be the servant of all, needs to be reflected amongst his followers and disciples. Is that right?
Amen. Absolutely right.
Dr. Bierman, would like to give you a few minutes to talk to us about Concordia Seminary in St. Louis and what you do there, and how Concordia is doing its work for preparing and equipping pastors for service in the church.
Appreciate that. At Concordia is one of the two seminaries that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has. Our focus here is to equip especially the leaders of the church for today and tomorrow. So we have a very strong pastoral training component. We have an MDiv, the granted degree, and we also do advanced degrees. We have a Master of Sacred Theology and a PhD in theology we all offer here. We also train deaconesses, and we train lay people. We have a fair amount of work we do intentionally geared for lay level, lay and student theology we offer from time to time. We don't have ongoing courses for that, but we have quite a bit available. And I would like to point out just to anybody who might be listening that if you're curious and going deeper into topics or learning more, the seminary does have a website where we have all this material available. It's at scholar.csl.edu. So that's scholar.csl.edu. And on that website, you can access literally tens of thousands of materials free for downloading. Lectures, chapel sermons, Bible studies, textual studies. There's exegetical things, systematic things, historical things, practical things, all sorts of things there. And it's free for the taking and to use. So I encourage you to check out that website and to see what might be available there. And I think you'll be quite surprised at all the material that is readily available. So our goal of the seminary is to aid the church in providing good, faithful teaching of God's reality for the sake of the church so that the gospel might be proclaimed and people might be encouraged and the church strengthened for her task in the future.
And you teach systematic theology. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, that's right. Our seminary divides the curriculum or the teaching up into four departments. This is kind of a classic move for the last couple hundred years, going back to the 19th century or so. And the idea is that we have an exegetical department then, a historical, a practical, and a systematic. So the exegetical department looks primarily at the text of the scriptures and bringing the meaning out and just examining what is the text saying, Old and New Testament. The historical department looks at what the church has taught in the history, early church, Middle Ages. We're very interested in Reformation history and even in more recent modern history. Then the practical department is dealing with the kind of concrete realities of life in the church, like preaching and leading meetings and doing education, just the conduct of real life ministry as a pastor. That's the practical department. And that leaves systematics. And the only thing left them probably is the doctrine. And that's what systematics does. Systematics is interested in the doctrinal teaching of the church, the catechetical instruction of people, the dogma of the church. That's what I do. So I'm very much interested in, as I would put it, taking God's truth, which is timeless, and applying it to the culture in which we live. And that's why I'm so interested in the culture in which that we're living in, because if we're going to speak God's truth faithfully to the people around us, we need to know where they're coming from. We need to know about that culture. We need to know which parts of God's truth to emphasize. God's truth doesn't change, but the culture is always shifting and moving. And so our application of God's truth is going to change, and what we teach and proclaim is going to be differently emphasized based on what's going on around. We don't change the truth, but we do change what we might emphasize about it.
Dr. Bierman, we'd like to thank you for joining us. I'd also like to encourage our listeners to grab a copy of Dr. Bierman's books, A Case for Character and Holy Citizens, W-H-O-L-L-Y, Citizens, and have a read of those, and you can find out more about what Dr. Bierman is saying. Thank you for helping us stay engaged with our culture, with our society, and we pray God's richest blessings upon you as you continue your work at Concordia Seminary. Thanks again for being our guest.
Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.